Hey everyone, I know last week I promised you that our technical difficulties would be fixed by this week's episode, but we are still troubleshooting some issues, so this episode is once again recorded using the microphone on Rebecca's laptop, and it isn't quite to the standards in audio quality that you've come to expect from the Messy Studio. We're doing our best to get things fixed for next week, so please bear with us. Thanks to everyone who's been sharing the show. We're seeing those numbers climb, and that's because you've been sharing the episodes on social media and sending them to people who you know will enjoy them. So if you're a new listener, please just judge us by episodes that are a few weeks old, not the last couple. This episode is really fun in spite of the audio being just a little bit rough, and we all need a little bit of fun right now, so let's just get right into it. Hello and welcome to The Messy Studio with Rebecca Kroll, the podcast at the intersection of art, travel, entrepreneurship, philosophy, and life in general. I am Ross Tickner, Rebecca's audio producer, podcast guru, and her son. On today's episode, we're cooking up something good. In our almost 3 years of recording podcasts, we have often found ourselves comparing cooking and art in terms of process and outcome. Since our podcast description includes life in general, we thought it would be fun to move away from the messy studio and into the messy kitchen for an episode that explores the ways that cooking and creating art share some aspects of creativity. With me, as always, is Rebecca Kroll.
Hello, everyone. And I have to say, my own kitchen is not particularly messy because I actually like a neat kitchen. So there are definitely differences between cooking and making art, at least where they're done. In the studio, I get so caught up in what I'm doing that I'm moving from thing to thing. I let things pile up, forget to put paint caps on and all that. And I let that happen, and I'm usually okay with that. Whereas the kitchen for me, I actually have to clean the kitchen before I cook. So I want, if there's any dishes sitting around, I gotta tidy everything up before I dive in. And don't ask me why. It's just, anyway, plenty of people do have messy kitchens and they love them. So we'll let you have whatever kind of creative space you want in your kitchen.
And it's funny because when I'm cooking professionally, because I do cook at work as a job.
Yeah.
And when I walk into the kitchen at work, I immediately clean the whole thing.
Right.
Like I show up at just before dinner rush, basically, typically on a normal day.
Yeah.
And I show up and I make sure that there's no dishes in the sink. I make sure all of my prep areas, my cut table and everything is clean. And I usually keep it that way throughout the evening. Like anytime I'm not actively, plating food or getting food out for a customer, I'm making sure that my space is just immaculate. And part of that is that customers see it, but part of it is also that, I want my cook space to be, I want to be able to work there. It's hard for me to work in a kitchen.
Well, and many people say that about their studios. They do not want studio mess.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know.
But when I'm at home, if there's a sink full of dishes and, I got to scrub a pan real quick before I cook in it, and I don't really worry about it too much at home.
I kind of know that.
Yeah, it's like the kitchen never really, I do clean it on a deep clean on a weekly basis, but it never really is immaculate the way that I feel it needs to be in order for me to work in a kitchen.
Yeah. And I, although we call this the messy studio, I know there are a lot of people that listen that, that's a difference. Their studio is not messy and they feel that way about their kitchens as well. Maybe their kitchens are messy. I don't know, but it's odd that there are different workspaces we have that we want them different ways. So, I don't know. That's one of the big differences between cooking and art that we're going to talk about and throw around here. Maybe for me, the biggest difference is when I cook, I'm more focused on the end product, the end result. I have something in mind and I want to get there. Sometimes I'm more open-ended. I'm just taking things out of the refrigerator and throwing them together kind of spontaneously. But usually I have something, a goal in mind, which is a little different than usually when I'm painting. Sometimes I have to say cooking is more like a chore. It's sort of something you have to do all the time. And if you don't like cooking, and you've already thought, I don't want to listen to this episode of The Messy Studio. It's about cooking. What we're going to try to do is just kind of celebrate the joy of cooking in relation to this creative process, which there are a lot of similarities. And like you said in the intro, we've oftentimes said, oh, that's kind of like cooking, you know, so we thought it was kind of time to get down to this.
Well, and we both like to cook, and so
we do.
For us, it's easy to see those connections and find the joy in both and the creativity in both aspects of,
yes.
of what we're doing. And I think I kind of hit on something right away when I was like, well, the kind of cooking I'm doing is different for different things.
Yes.
You know, there's a professional atmosphere. You're just doing it for you. And
yes.
then there's maybe more like date night or something where you're cooking for somebody else or
right.
you're cooking for a dinner party. And these are all very different kinds of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And art is kind of the same way. We have things that we do that are personal for us that are maybe a personal gift for somebody else or commissioned work. And then there's stuff that we're doing that is more like just kind of the work that we're producing on a regular basis. Is for sale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And whether you're thinking of an audience or not, as you do with when people are coming over for dinner or something. And some people find that situation very intimidating. If they're somewhat tentative at cooking and they have people coming over, you know, it can be pretty anxious. And what I was thinking about, one of the things that came to mind when I was writing up, we have a very few notes today, actually. We're sort of rambling. But when I was writing up some notes, I thought, you know, there's a feeling you get in the studio when you know, a lot of people call it flow. I do too. You're sort of on top of your game. You say, I need this. I need that. I need to do this here. Oh, that's great. And time kind of drops away. You're just feeling a mastery, I guess, of what you're doing. And it's very enjoyable. If you have a sense of that in the kitchen, And you have people coming over, whatever you're doing, maybe you're cooking for some Thanksgiving or some bigger thing, it can be a very similar feeling. You know, you've got everything timed just right, and this is going to come out of the oven when I'm ready to put that in. And it's exciting to pull it all together and have it come out, you know. And sometimes it does it, and you go, oh, well, you know, so the potatoes are a little burned or something. But, I mean, you have to have that same kind of, you know, well, okay, we're not always perfect attitude as you do in the studio. But that the joy of that feeling when you're just pulling stuff off, I guess, you're making it work, to me is a very strong parallel to the studio. And it's also similar, and, you know, you've accumulated the experience to be able to do this. Nobody cooks like that the first couple times they cook. And over time, you know, you just get so you understand the rhythms and you understand what's needed, and it's all part of that kind of growing experience. And really, there are a lot of artists that excel at cooking, which is interesting. It's kind of like it's a creative activity, but there's a lot less at stake. It's ephemeral, so you mess up a dinner, so you know. Maybe you're slightly embarrassed if you're cooking for other people, but hey, you know, there's another dinner tomorrow or something. And it has a little more of a relaxing attitude maybe than you get in the studio, where you can feel like everything is kind of important. Usually it's pretty low stress. And there's a interesting whole category called artists who write cookbooks. So I Googled this. Because I knew that there were some that had written some, and sometimes they're fun. I haven't really read any, but the descriptions are kind of include the lifestyle in which they were cooking. So it mentioned Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner, his wife, wrote a cookbook about dinner parties that they held in their country studio place, where the people would come over, and you kind of get this picture of the sort of bohemian atmosphere back in the 60s, and everybody's getting together and they're cooking up something, and you know, it's kind of part of the era. But plenty of artists right now love cooking. And a few of the other cookbooks I came across, Giorgio,
hold on, what kind of stuff was Jackson Pollock cooking?
I can't remember now. I think it was some kind of beef or something, like a stew or a roast or something. But that was just I don't know.
Okay.
I haven't seen the book, and I'm sure there's all kinds of stuff in there, but there was something mentioned in this review A George O'Keefe wrote one, and I have flipped through that one at a bookstore around here in New Mexico. And she was, you know, if you picture George O'Keefe, she's kind of a spare individual, you know, somewhat severe looking. And her cooking was apparently quite basic, but really good. And she knew how to use, you know, local ingredients and whatnot. And that's one I wouldn't mind owning because I live in the places near where she worked and lived. Frida Kahlo has one, and she's an artist many people are familiar with. She's no longer alive, but many people know her work and that she was married to Diego Rivera, and they lived in Mexico. And so, again, very culturally local food that they excelled at making. So, oh, Salvador Dali also has a cookbook, so that one I really wonder about.
Oh, goodness.
Let your imagination wander with that. You know, and I think it kind of brings up the sensory aspect of cooking includes not only taste, but often the visual. So there's another crossover. You know, you want the food to look good and how it's presented and how it's plated and the colors that go together and textures. And so I have to think that people that are that both create art and are and love to cook, there's definitely some of that going on.
Well, there's definitely an aspect of playing with the sensory experience as an artist, and cooking allows you to play with more senses, with taste and smell. And I think there's also, you know, we've talked a lot about, I remember one time you mentioned the kind of the cliche, how long did it take you to make that? Well, it took me a lifetime.
Yes.
And there's this sense in that how long it takes you to create a piece of art is not what gives it value. It's all the experience that you have that gives you the ability to make that piece of art. And that's very obvious with cooking.
Yes.
And it's something that I think people experience very directly. They know what bad cooking is, and they know what good cooking is, and they know just how much it takes to become a good cook.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that experience, building on experience, having things fail, figuring out, okay, next time I can't cook it that long or whatever it is. And that, you know, I'm kind of fascinated with this visual aspect of food. How many people put pictures of their food up on Facebook? And some people don't like that. I never mind. I look at it and say, oh, that looks interesting. That looks good. And it's not just what it is, but how it looks. We have a very gut level appreciation or sensory appreciation when we see, say, a loaf of bread that's all, you know, crispy around the edges and beautifully brown. It's, oh, I can just taste it, you know. And it's very, very much sensory. And so when you're cooking and you think, well, I have to laugh about this. I remember a lesson from high school home economics class, okay, which was all girls in those days. Only girls had to know how to cook. And I remember, this is probably the only thing I remember, the teacher saying, okay, you never want to have a meal that's all white. Like, you wouldn't cook a white fish, white potatoes, and serve cauliflower with it. That just, no, you don't do that. And, you know, at the time I thought, well, it did make sense on some level, but I kind of get it now. And I actually think about that when I'm planning a meal. I don't want the all white meal because I like that bit of color that, you know, the green beans next to the potatoes or something. And it's a basic tenet of, you know, preparing a menu is that you're going to have different colors and textures. And so it's not just the individual dish, it's how they go together in a meal. And again, I mean, I suppose there's parallels in your studio where you kind of want the work to relate to each other in some way, and it's a back and forth conversation. Of course, it's much more momentary in a meal, but it's the same kind of appreciation that these different things can relate to each other, and they can complement each other, and they can also be really different. So, I don't know. There's just a lot of things. One of the things I have talked about when I talk about personal voice, and this is an analogy I came up with. That's about the sources of our ideas. So sometimes people, well, they often create intuitively, or they haven't really figured out where they get their ideas or what it is, or maybe they're stuck for ideas. And I like to think of these sources of ideas and the aspects of our personal voice as a stew or a soup that you're cooking. And And in this soup or stew, there's a lot of different ingredients and different vegetables. And, you know, if you're a meat eater, you've got some beef or something in there. And it's all bubbling and boiling, and it's all mingling. So the flavor that comes out of it is unique. And that's, to me, analogous to our personal voice, because we brought all these different things together. And they've marinated and they've simmered together. And so what do we bring forth out of that? And then at certain times when you're boiling a soup or something, you know, maybe the carrot will float to the top or the piece of pasta or whatever it is. And it's also the way that things come forward in our work in different ways. Maybe right now I'm interested in color, so that's becoming more important in my work. It's always been part of the mix. It's always been part of the flavor, but right now that's a stronger flavor. And so I just like that mental image, all this stuff stewing and cooking, which is kind of going on all the time in the background of our what we draw upon for our work. And then to think about, well, what are those ingredients? You know, what are my carrots and celery, and how do they affect each other? So that kind of mingling and stuff, I kind of like that idea.
Real quick, I want to take a quick minute to let our listeners know about a big change that's coming to Squeegee Press. Known for its award-winning book, videos, workshops, and tools, all created for artists working with cold wax medium. Rebecca and her partner, Jerry McLaughlin, have announced that later this month, Squeegee Press will become Cold Wax Academy and will soon include some exciting new membership features. As part of this change, their video, Cold Wax Medium, a video workshop, will become available as streaming content for members only. And everyone, this is your last chance to get this video. If you want to have a hard copy of it, it's nearly 7 hours long and it covers everything that Rebecca and Jerry teach in a 5-day workshop and more. So it's on sale. If you prefer to own it, it's on sale right now for $250 off. And this is, like I say, this is the last chance to get it because this sale ends at the end of September and then access is going to shift to streaming content only. So to purchase and for more information, please visit www.squeegeepress.com and don't forget to join the mailing list for updates on the all new offerings from Cold Wax Academy. All right, let's get back to the show.
Okay, thanks, Ross. So we were talking about this bubbling stew of influences and ideas and all that stuff. And
right.
It kind of makes me think too about patience, because in order to get that really flavorful stew, you don't just throw it on the stove and eat it in 20 minutes, right? I mean, it takes time. It takes time to integrate the flavors and mingle and, you know, develop. And so patience is often really important in cooking as well as in the studio. Lots of people have wrecked cooking something because they took it out of the oven too soon or took it off the stovetop too soon before it was really fully cooked. And that's analogous, of course, to quitting too soon on something you're working on, saying, oh, that's good enough, that's fine. And as well, the other end of it, overcooking, overworking, over becoming too perfectionistic about something. And overcooking, obviously, can wreck food pretty fast. So you're trying to find that you know, that really nice place where it's just done. It's just perfectly finished. And it's always a challenge in the studio to know when that is. And it's kind of a interesting analogy there, I think. Let's see, what else? The aspect of inventing, of being inventive. So many times people that are, you know, good cooks or comfortable with cooking really don't plan a meal until, you know, they're going to plan dinner at 5:30 or 6 o'clock and say, okay, what have I got? What can I do? And what can I, you know, what things would be good together? And so there's this spontaneity or this intuitive aspect to it that can come when you're experienced. If you're not very experienced, you're probably planning a menu, you're using recipes, maybe you're planning your shopping, and there's a parallel there to when you're starting something new in the studio. A lot of people need and want to seek information about a new material or a new process that they're going into. And they want to make the best of their time and not waste materials and all that sort of thing. So they're looking for information. People that cook a lot, you know, tend to not use a lot of recipes, or maybe start with a recipe but say, well, but I don't have that thing, so maybe I can use this thing instead, you know. Personally, I rely on recipes when I bake, because the chemistry of baking is not something that I've really understood. When do you use baking soda? When do you use baking powder? How many eggs to what percentage of flour? You know, this sort of thing is not something that comes to my mind right away. So I almost always follow a baking recipe pretty closely. But I've known people that say, cake, okay, and start throwing things in a mixing bowl, and they have a cake. You know, I admire that. That's a real skill.
There's definitely a sense in which you need to be relying on recipes when you first start out. And and when you're learning how to cook, and if you have the level of experience necessary to bake without a recipe, then I think that's just somebody who's really got that dialed in.
Yes.
But even when you're just cooking like a simple pasta dish or something, when you're first learning how to cook, you really do need to rely on recipes, because you don't necessarily understand how much of this spice do I need to use,
right,
or how much of how much oil, so it's kind of funny actually, because my fiance Kara is not a great cook, but she's really trying to learn how.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been cooking my whole life. And,
yes, you have.
In a big way, it comes from having this kind of restrictive diet. I haven't eaten chicken, beef, or pork in close to 25 years. And so when you're now we say pescatarian, but that really wasn't a term that was used back then. You were just a vegetarian who ate fish. So,
right.
But when you have a restrictive diet, you really need to know how to cook for yourself, and because you can't be relying on other people to make accommodations for this diet necessarily, and so it's something that you do out of necessity, but also you can't have that kind of voluntarily restrictive diet if you're not into cooking. You know, it's kind of a chicken egg thing, you know, which came first, the desire to cook or the necessity to cook for yourself. But in any case, Kara is trying to learn how to cook, and she's a very creative person, and she looks at a recipe and she instantly wants to start making changes to it. Like,
aww.
Oh, I want to do more of this. Yeah. And it's really fun. But at the same time, I'm like, the first time we make this, let's just follow the recipe.
Right.
You know, let's just follow the recipe the first time, and then we can figure out what we want to change about it. Because otherwise, you may be making changes that make sense in your head, but they don't actually work in the real world.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, because she is learning. You know, what's she going to be cooking up in 5 years or something? I think she's going to be a really good cook.
Yeah, yeah.
Because of that kind of inventive spirit and creativity that she's bringing to it as a person with an art background. So that's pretty cool. You know, another thing that comes to mind, we did a recent episode about mixed media. And one of the things that happens in mixed media sometimes is people end up with something that isn't really working because they're sort of dumping, as long as we're on kitchen analogies, everything but the kitchen sink on their piece. Right? It's kind of indiscriminate. They're grabbing all kinds of things. Now, that may be really intentional, and you know, they know what they're doing. But for other people, it ends up in the trash because it's just too much, too many different things that aren't working together. And that's a really key aspect of cooking, where there's a selection. You're making a selection of spices or something, and you're saying, you know, if I get too many spices in there that aren't related, it's not really, there's not going to be a flavor that comes through as kind of a dominant flavor or a pleasing flavor. It's just going to taste weird, you know? So that idea of a little bit of restraint and selection and editing, maybe, as we say with the paintings or artwork, is also part of cooking. And it's something you learn, as you're saying, starting with maybe more of a recipe, and then playing around with it. Maybe some a little more oregano, right. or this, I could use a little more cinnamon in this thing I'm baking. And I remember the same person I knew that would make cakes just out of her head, she always said, you know, always put more vanilla in than it says. And I found that to be true. And it doesn't really alter the consistency of a cake or something if you add another teaspoon of vanilla, but it really does perk up the flavor. And so, you know, and I'm sure it's something she just played around with and said, I think I'll try that, you know. Anyway.
Well, it's interesting, too, how two different people can cook the same recipe and even use the same amounts of the same ingredients, and it doesn't necessarily come out exactly the same. There's something of the cook that becomes a part of the meal.
Something.
And it's something that I think like fast food franchises have been struggling with for years and years. How do we make a completely consistent product? But there's still, you know, the good Taco Bell in town. You know what, yeah. I mean? There's somebody there who's rocking it out and really knows the ingredients,
yeah.
really well, or something. I have no idea what it is. But you could take two very talented cooks and give them the same ingredients and the same recipe, and there will be variations that make that a meal that comes from that individual.
Right, or one that's quite successful. And that's another thing people sometimes talk about, an artist who's quite good. They'll say, I don't know, but she or he just has this it factor. I mean, they just have it. And it's hard to put your finger on what it is. And I think that happens with cooking as well. Some people could cook almost anything and it's going to be really delicious. And other people really struggle and they don't have that many successes. And I don't know what it is. It's the it factor. And, you know, if you do struggle with cooking, you don't like it and you make stuff that isn't very good, I don't know what the answer is. I mean, you know, we're not a cooking advice podcast, but,
right.
I wonder if it is something about loosening up a little bit and following more intuition, instead of absolutely following a recipe, coming at it with a little bit looser attitude of, hey, you know, it seems to me that I could add a little more milk into this or something, and trying it. And I don't know. I'm mystified by that.
I think it's like anything else where if you do it 10,000 times, you're an expert.
Yeah.
And it just takes that repetition of doing it over and over again. You start to get a feel of these really minute differences in, mm-hmm. in the way that you do things that end up creating big changes. And the same is absolutely true of your artwork as well. There's yep. there's a level of expertise that you get that just comes through repetition.
Yeah, and also understanding little tips and tricks and, you know, how do you mince the garlic easily and well or something like that. And it's absolutely same in the studio.
Smack it with a cast iron frying pan.
Oh, come on. I just bought this cool little device. It's like a little rocker and it rocks over the garlic clove. And oh, it's so cool, you know, and it's same kind of, it's same kind of feeling I get when I get a new tool in the studio. Oh, let's see what this can do. You know, there's a joy in cooking in your actual tools. As well as the ingredients. I mean, that having that perfect, you know, casserole pan or that wonderful knife that cuts everything just right. And it's worth, I feel, if you like cooking, to invest in those things that make your job easier and it's more fun than struggling with something that doesn't really work all that well. And
right. And there's always some new device that's super interesting that can change the way that you do things. And it's the same thing in the studio, too. There's always some new tool that you're excited about or some,
absolutely.
You know, some new color.
And at the same time, you know, you can cook really great meals with very simple tools and pots and pans. And you can do the same in the studio with very simple tools and ingredients, call paint or whatever ingredients. And it's fun to have all those other things and you can, you know, you can see the benefit of it. But you can also make do with, and anybody who's been camping knows, hey, you can get by with very little over a campfire and make some pretty good stuff.
Right.
And it's that kind of the necessity of simplifying and making do.
I think it's really fun too to try to make a meal that is the most delicious meal I can make for like $1.
Right.
like really try to get creative with just the cheapest, simplest ingredients that I possibly can.
Would that be a ramen based meal then?
You know, I do a lot of stuff with ramen noodles.
Ramen is awful.
I do a lot of stuff with yeah, cheap bags of frozen vegetables, you know. I like to do some stuff with just really, really just the cheapest stuff I can get at the grocery store. And, you know, it's not necessarily the healthiest food. I'll be the first to admit that. But it's, you know, it's something that came from out of necessity of living on a budget. And,
yeah.
But then I, over time, came up with some recipes that I just kind of fell in love with. And now they're comfort food for me.
And they're your thing.
And I'm sure that we all have things like that.
Yeah.
We all have a mac and cheese recipe or something that costs less than $1 to make.
Right.
You know, and you come out with this really great homemade mac and cheese.
You know, when you were talking about having to learn how to cook because you wanted vegetarian food, you know, I think back in the day, and I remember you cooking an amazing meal when you were 12 years old, and it always stuck in my mind. You planned it. Oh, my God, it was amazing. We had people over, and you cooked for them. I don't know if you remember that. You were grilling things.
Oh, yeah.
It was in the summer. And so, you know, you were using good ingredients and all that, but it reminded me of this friend of ours that we had when I was in grad school, and he was a vegetarian, but we called him the junk food vegetarian because he didn't cook. And he would eat, I mean, I don't know what he subsisted on, you know, Twinkies or something, just like junk food.
Well, Twinkies aren't vegetarians.
Well,
so
that's true. That's true. Not Twinkies then. something else. They probably have lard in them or something. But
yeah, exactly.
but he would, you know, he did subsist on some pretty terrible junk food, but it was vegetarian. So I always thought vegetarianism and health food don't necessarily walk hand in hand.
Oh, they certainly don't. Yeah, the health benefits that you see, I think, from vegetarianism or veganism are largely associated from getting all of the processed junk food out
yes.
of your diet, because most of that stuff is out the window once you start doing a restrictive diet.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I think that there certainly are health benefits, but that's where they're mostly coming from.
Yeah.
I'm sure that someone will argue with me about that, and that's fine.
Well, yes. Well, vegetarian is another huge topic that maybe we don't have time to get into.
Right. But even eating very cheaply, you know, basic kind of frozen vegetables are good for you, you know, and they're maybe not as good as organic fresh vegetables, but they're still good for you. And there's certainly a lot of things that you can do with really basic ingredients and really flare them up and get excited about them, even though they're not the most exciting things in the world. I think that we've all experienced those things when they're cooked in a bland way.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
we all had, you know, school cafeteria food or something where these, you know, frozen vegetables were just kind of boiled and served, you know, we know the difference between that and something that's prepared properly.
You can absolutely throw them in a stir fry or whatever. And they're typically frozen, you know, at peak perfection. So it is something that if you buy at the grocery store and you're letting it sit around, or it's already sat around, that it may not be actually as fresh as a frozen thing. I know we're kind of running out of time here, but I just wanted to mention one last thing, because cooking obviously is a form of self-expression, like stuff we do in the studio. And one of the ways I think is really interesting is the cultural connections with cooking. So that if you come from a cultural background that has certain types of food, and learning how to cook those foods and connecting with that part of your heritage is really interesting. And, you know, again, I know of people who didn't necessarily grow up with that in their homes, and the food was pretty, you know, basic American food, whatever. But through grandparents or cookbooks or whatever, have learned how to cook some of the things that were more culturally associated with their family history, that becomes a real source of connection and enjoyment with that part of themselves. And so there's so much cultural about food, even within this country. What part of the country do you come from? What are the popular foods, say, in Wisconsin? You know, it's a fish fry and cheese curds and beer, you know. And out here in New Mexico, it's a totally different basic cultural diet. And so that whole aspect of food, I think, is really wonderful. And it's a way that we can, you know, get a taste of, shall we say, different cultures by going to restaurants or if we have friends that cook this way. And it's really very expansive. And I guess if I'm pressed to make an analogy to what you do in the studio, you know, we often look at other people's artwork and say, I don't quite get it. I don't know where that comes from. But let me try it. You know, let me see how they did this. How does it work? And in that way, just expand our appreciation so much of what other people are doing, and not always coming from the perspective of our own background.
Right. Well, and it's interesting how these different cultures can combine to create new cuisines or new dining experiences as well.
Mm-hmm.
In Wisconsin, I think of supper clubs, which are something that we understand very well in Wisconsin that maybe other people don't really understand what it is.
Right.
But it's hard to describe what a supper club is, really. Like, you know it if you've been to one. There's just certain characteristics that all supper clubs have,
right?
At least in Wisconsin. But the best way that I can describe it is that it's really like a fusion cuisine and dining experience. It's a combination of French, German, and Scandinavian, which is really what the cultural background of Wisconsin is.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of these kind of like I've had escargot at a supper club before.
Mm-hmm.
It's in many ways it's like a highbrow dining experience, and yet you'll see, you know, farmers in their coveralls at these places.
And my image of supper clubs is they always have a relish tray, which is quite elaborate. And they bring this thing to your
table. Yeah, there's always a relish tray.
And then the other thing is taxidermied animals on the walls.
Usually, quite often.
Usually bears or deer.
Yeah, I feel like the decor is almost always like from the 70s. You know, there's usually like carpet on the walls.
Yes.
And like Formica bar tops. And things like that, and you got to have a brandy old fashioned when you go.
I was gonna say the hallmark also is ice cream based alcoholic drinks. So
yeah, grasshoppers and stuff like that. Yeah.
So yeah, last summer I went with some friends to a supper club, in Wisconsin, and we had fish fry and ice cream drinks. So you know, we were totally we were there.
Yeah, usually there's a salad bar as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Although the salad bar is maybe going to become a thing of the past with everything that the country is kind of going through right now.
But that would be mostly iceberg lettuce and carrot sticks or something. But anyway.
I've seen some really good salad bars at supper clubs, actually.
Mm.
And I feel like there's different levels of supper club, too. There's the ones that are more like kind of homey kind of backwoods bars
kind of
that have just this supper club meal atmosphere, and there's one in Eau Claire that I think of specifically that's like that, and then there's also the more high elevated, higher brow kind of finer dining experience,
white tablecloths and whatnot. Yeah. Anyway,
but it's something that's uniquely Wisconsin that I think right. People from Wisconsin really understand the supper club, and people from outside of this area are probably just, what are you guys talking about? But if anyone listening makes it to Wisconsin, you need to go to a supper club. Like, just trust us. You need to go to a supper club and just go on a Friday and get fish fry if you can. But yeah, it's a very uniquely, it's this cultural fusion thing. That's where it comes from. And mm-hmm. so it's the other one that I think of that's kind of like that is Italian cuisine as we think of it in America,
mm-hmm.
which really came from Manhattan. And it's a fusion of all of these different styles of Italian food. That came over with immigrants who were all of a sudden living in the same neighborhood in New York, rather than spread out across an entire country, in Italy. And so there's fusions of these different Italian styles that are specific to different regions in Italy that became American style Italian food.
Yeah, and you know, I think I guarantee any part of the country, you're going to find something that is uniquely that area. I mean, around here, it's these very small, New Mexican food is its own thing.
Yeah, it's different from Texan food. It's different from authentic Mexican cuisine. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's its own region, its own thing.
And so there's a lot of very small restaurants around here that maybe have just a few tables, and it's a very interesting experience to go in those and say, I'm not in Wisconsin anymore. You know, it's just so right. Every part of the country, I bet, has something like that. That's really, you kind of go, yeah, this is, I mean, okay, one last story. I remember going with you to a little place. I guess it was actually a bar, but they were having a fish fry. And do you remember this place where all the decor on the table and the chandeliers and everything made out of...
It was empty beer containers, right? Yeah.
Yes. So these six-pack beer containers, they had made chandeliers out of these things. And on the table, you know, all the condiments and all that stuff were separated into the six-pack beer containers. And so it was, you know, like those cardboard things that you would put bottles into. And we were just cracking up about it. And I guess that's a good way to end, because this is like creative use of something connected with the restaurant and the cuisine, making this stuff out of the, it was just interesting and charming and a bit strange.
Right. Well, and it's what we get from food in terms of the flavor and the atmosphere and everything. But really that sense of taste and smell, it's very much connected to memory, and it's something that is, it's so important in terms of our enjoyment of life, and we take it for granted if it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think it's something that we don't necessarily, appreciate the way that we should. I know that you don't want to talk about COVID stuff, but... a close friend of mine recently recovered from COVID-19, and he completely lost his sense of taste and smell.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have a whole lot of other symptoms. He's fine, and he's out of quarantine now and getting back to normal. That loss of the sense of taste and smell was really destructive to him.
Oh,
in
I
ways
bet.
That you might not really appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
He was telling me about going to his refrigerator and taking spoonfuls of horseradish sauce and like lemon juice and things like that, just to try to taste something, just trying to get the strongest flavors he could, just to try to taste something.
It's hard to
and
imagine.
Yeah, he told me that his life got literally very bland and very dull. He was locked in his house. He's somebody who really appreciates food, and he likes to cook. And this was something that completely destroyed that aspect of his life.
Oh.
And he was never in danger of going to the hospital or dying or the really just other destructive things that make people afraid of this virus. But just that small thing, that small symptom of losing taste and smell was really destructive.
How long does that go on? How long did he have that?
He was telling me that they have patients who had the virus 2 months ago who still haven't gotten their taste and smell back.
Wow.
And you know, they're free of the virus, but that sense hasn't come back.
Oh, I hope it does.
there's a concern that for some people it may be permanent.
Oh no.
And so it's something that's not widely publicized with coronavirus as like a danger.
And it can affect your nutrition as well. I mean, you lose interest in food if you can't taste or smell.
Well, it might affect him positively, to be honest with you. He might. I mean, if you're only eating for sustenance, then, you know, you can just eat like, I don't know, really, really lean, unseasoned chicken breast or broccoli or something like that. Just eat entirely for nutrient value.
But, it kind of goes back to that importance of the sensory experience, you know, with art as well. And you say, you know, we take that for granted, that ability to taste and smell, and then we take often take, aesthetics for granted as well. We sort of expect to be surrounded by things that are good to look at. And just to whatever extent we own art or we have it in our environment, or even just nicely, you know, nice fabrics or something. And it's, you know, it's that connection, that human connection with something creative that was, that we can respond to. It's really basic. And, you know, when we were talking about the supper clubs and all that, and the places here and there, the sense of place also, that's something a lot of artists like to bring to their work. They're working from either a physical place, a landscape, or some maybe metaphorical place, something about their background or something they're interested in. And they want to bring that kind of hard to pin down sometimes. The phrase, a sense of place, is often used in art. And I think that's so applicable to food, what our place, where we're living, brings to the food, whether it's our own home environment that we're used to or whether we've gone somewhere else. If you travel, a big part of it is experiencing the food of the area. So anyway, lots and lots of little threads here. We've been rambling a bit, but it's so funny because for so long we've been talking and say, oh, that's like cooking or that's like food. You know, I guess it was time to take it on.
Yeah, this was one of those fun episodes where you send me the notes and there's really not a whole lot there, but we managed to talk for, this is one of our longer episodes.
But. I know. Well, if we've held on to our listeners through all this, thank you and go cook something.
Well, do you have any final thoughts to wrap up this episode?
I just think creative flow is one of the best things we experience as people and as artists and as cooks and any way that you can find it. And it's interesting to me that historically there is a connection between artists and cooking. And I mentioned the cookbooks, but, you know, it goes beyond that. And one time a friend said to me, I don't trust an artist who can't cook. I thought, really? And, you know, that's a little bit extreme, but I think what that was saying was there's that creative connection. And oftentimes, and I certainly say there are many artists who can't cook, and that's just absolutely fine, or don't like to cook. But those that have that creative connection have one more outlet for expressing, you know, who they are and what they like, what they're interested in, and how they can relate to other people and all that stuff. So enough said.
All right, well, that just about wraps up this episode of The Messy Studio.
For more from The Messy Studio, please check out www.messystudiopodcast.com and sign up for the email list. You can also find The Messy Studio on Facebook, as well as public profiles for both Rebecca Kroll and myself, Ross Tickner. For more from Rebecca Kroll, please check out www.rebeccakroll.com and www.squeegeepress.com and sign up for the email lists to stay up to date on events, book signings, and openings. The Messy Studio Podcast is a Core Publication Management production. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again next week with more art and entertainment. In the meantime,
embrace your creative space,
messy or otherwise.
Thanks, everybody.